You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. In the details, what you should know about Molly McNerney, a panoply of eccentric biographical data re the Kimmel Show's Fierce Mother, with photographs by Randall Slavin. Molly McNerney's 2017 teetered uncertainly between Annus Mirabilis and Annus Horribilis. The co-head writer of Jimmy Kimmel Live since 2008, she saw her program celebrated as a comedic bulwark against ACA repeal madness, and she played a major role in shaping Kimmel's material for the Academy Awards. On top of that, McNerney gave birth to her and Kimmel's second child, a boy named Billy, in April. The two have been married since 2013 and also have a 3-year-old daughter, Jane. But Billy's arrival came with a scare. He was born with a congenital heart defect that has required 2 open-heart surgeries to date. While Billy is bearing up well, McNerney and Kimmel's new resolve in taking on political issues, from gun control to the inequities in this country's health care system, has ruffled some feathers. Most notably, Alabama's rootin-tootin' Roy Moore challenged Kimmel to come to his state to settle their differences man to man. Herewith, as McNerney juggles her day job, motherhood, her preparations for a second consecutive Kimmel-hosted Oscars telecast, her impending 40th birthday, March 13th, and the daily challenge of being funny in the face of too much crazy, are some facts and insights gleaned from an afternoon visit to her workplace. She grew up in the St. Louis suburb of Chesterfield, Missouri, in a loving family that was, she says, middle class, sometimes dipping into working class. She characterizes her upbringing as Irish Catholic conservative, with a dog named Shamrock, and the belief, imparted to her by her parents, Mike and Mickey, that Republicans want to give power to people and Democrats want to give power to government. She saved up her allowance as a child to buy her father a gaudy necktie from Rush Limbaugh's No Boundaries collection. She admired Diane Sawyer as a girl, making homemade videos in which, in character as Sawyer, she reported on local goings-on in Chesterfield. She began to formulate her own political beliefs shortly after her graduation from the University of Kansas, when she moved to Chicago and started meeting people who weren't like me. She upped sticks and set out for Los Angeles, not knowing a soul besides her then-boyfriend, with whom she had been in a long-distance relationship. The boyfriend didn't pan out, but L.A. did. Soon after their breakup, in 2003, she found a job as an assistant to Jimmy Kimmel Live, executive producer. She had never seen the program nor heard of Kimmel. She was a work colleague of Kimmel's long before they were a couple, and prefers to maintain certain boundaries on the set. There will be times when he will naturally put his arm around me, and I always swat it away. It's become a joke, she says. She is the inventor of the show's popular Celebrities Read Mean Tweets segment, right down to its use of R.E.M.'s Everybody Hurts. The song reminds me of high school and feeling sorry for myself, she says. She normally receives Kimmel's opening monologue at around 4 p.m. for a lookover. But on Kimmel's first night back on the air after Billy's birth, he didn't send it to McNerney, telling her, "I think you just need to hear it when I say it for the first time." She watched her husband's impassioned monologue from home while breastfeeding Billy and burst into tears. "It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen," she said, "so vulnerable and raw. He had zero to gain from that and many things to lose. She and Kimmel both remain observant Catholics, attending Mass with some regularity. She had her daughter Jane baptized in the church. However, the very day of the baptism, she handwrote Jane a letter to be read at a later date, in which McNearly explains why I baptized her and what I know sucks about the church. In other words, that it doesn't allow women to be priests or homosexuals to get married. She is pained that her father voted for Donald Trump, but pleased that he has come to regret his vote. She learned of his regret when Mike, who had impulsively moved to Puerto Rico from St. Louis to run a bicycle rental business, lost contact with his family for several days after Hurricane Maria's landfall. He finally resurfaced after waiting several hours to buy a single gallon of gas for $60, just so that he could charge his phone in his car and send Molly an email that read, "Trump is an ass." She reckons that, at the rate that Hollywood power players are being exposed as sexual predators, the Dolby Theater audience, to whom Kimmel will be performing on March 4th, will be a room full of women, plus some really nice guys like Tom Hanks. From James Walcott comes this article, Revival of the Fittest. New York City in the 1970s was nirvana for the obsessive moviegoer, dotted with revival houses, only two of which would survive. Happily, they now have reinforcements, though they all face a new quandary. Opening photo, Screen Gems. The New Yorker Theater, one of many repertory houses that flourished in the city in the early 1970s. And on the marquee of that theater it says, today only, Shirley Booth and Thornton Wilder's The Matchmaker, also the hoodlum priest. Hop into the Wayback Machine, spin the dial to Manhattan, 1973, pop open the portal door, and voila, a crumbling, reeking, nerve-scraping, hieroglyphic-graffitied urban scape beckons. It is not the meticulously curated set of HBO's The Deuce, but the real, raw, shaking disco inferno. The streets throng with shifty lowlifes for whom Ratso Rizzo was a role model. Subway trains are crime scenes in progress and rolling theaters of the absurd. But if the city on a bad day evokes a Hieronymus Bosch mural, it's a near heavenly time to be an obsessive moviegoer, assuming you can get to and from the theater in one piece. Before DVDs, streaming services, and cable's respite from life's woes, that is Turner Classic Movies, revival houses were where epiphany-seeking cinephiles and less exalted film junkies could dip into the dark for a few hours and cut their Dracula fangs on Hollywood golden oldies, the latest foreign craze, avant-garde provocations, and camp treasures with cult followings, the immortal Maria Montez and Cobra Woman. Scan the movie listings, and here's what's on tap. Charlie Chaplin's Limelight at the Art on East 8th. Broadway Melody of 1936. And Broadway Melody of 1938 at Theater 80 St. Mark's. Last year at Marienbad at the Quad. Ozu's Tokyo Story and Elaine Rene's Je T'aime, Je T'aime at the Playboy. A mascara diptych of death in Venice and performance at the New Yorker, which was operated in the early awakening 60s by Dan Talbot, whose death in December ended a long life valiantly devoted to the advocacy, screening, and distribution of venturesome cinema. East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause at the Thalia. In Times Square, Deuce territory, the marquees of grindhouse flea pits blazed with horror, martial arts, skin flick double features that thrilled the freaky taste buds and rotted the fillings of a generation of dedicated sickies. Revival houses in the 70s, nearly all of them shoestring operations, had their own distinct character, a creaky, lived-in, refuge-for-lost-souls wombiness that honored the passage of time and fostered sinking into reverie. It was as if the graininess of the films seeped into the worn carpets and seat cushions. The Elgin, despite its deco exterior, preserved during its renovation and resurrection as the Joyce, home to contemporary dance, had a disreputable mise-en-scene, perhaps the residue of its midnight showings of John Waters' Pink Flamingos. Architecturally, the Thalia was a true weirdo, with its reverse parabolic floor and flimsy soundproofing. Ventilation didn't seem to be a priority either. The air in the theater seemed left over from FDR's third term, one Thalia veteran recalled. Now an adjunct to Symphony Space, the Thalia has been handsomely remodernized and rechristened the Leonard Nimoy Thalia. The seats at Theater 80 St. Mark's were a stress test for the lumbar region, and the rear screen projection often made black and white films look bleachy, but the concession bar served Colombian coffee singular then, and the audiences seemed more collegial than those at revival houses that attracted more solitary jaybirds. The much-traveled prints were usually far from pristine, at worst a flickering strip of scratches, blotches, missing frames, and faded colors. But there's something to be said for encountering art in a primitive condition. It makes the synapses work a little harder. Like it or no, Woody Allen has done more than any other actor-director to enshrine the integral role of the revival house in the dating rituals and cultural upholstering of the baby boomer urbanite. In Annie Hall, Allen's Alvy Singer drags Diane Keaton's Annie to see the sorrow and the pity at the New Yorker. In Crimes and Misdemeanors, his mansplainer takes his young niece to the Bleecker Street Cinema for Hitchcock's Mr. and Mrs. Smith for some tutoring and advice dispensing. And in Hannah and Her Sisters, Allen's distraught Mickey staggers into a showing of the Marx Brothers' Anarchic Duck Soup at the Metro and finds it the consoling antidote to mortal despair. One by one, these theaters closed, grave markers in a lost New York. When Theater 80 St. Mark's sealed its tomb in the summer of 1994, the New York Times ran a eulogy titled New York's Revival Houses, and then there was one, the sole survivor holding down the fort being Film Forum. For some reason, the Times overlooked anthology film archives in the East Village, still alive and kicking today. Film Forum remains a bastion of established greats, retrospectives, and major excavations. The first U.S. release of Rainer Werner Fassbinder's miniseries 8 Hours Don't Make a Day. Now it has reinforcements. In March 2016, the Metrograph, a new art revival house, opened on the Lower East Side, its festivities drawing Illuminati such as Greta Gerwig, Jim Jarmusch, Sofia Coppola, and the Vincent Price of auteurism, John Waters. The Metrograph immediately earned its eagle wings by unspooling a retrospective of the director Jean Eustache, showcasing Eustache's rarely seen 3.5-hour miserabilist masterpiece, The Mother and the Whore, a movie where existential and penitential were conjoined. Unlike the revival houses of yore, the Metrograph doesn't rely on a revolving slate of double features, but focuses on special events and guest coups, such as the Brian De Palma retro, with the safari-jacketed director himself appearing for a Q&A. Its restaurant, bars, snack shop, lobby, bookstore, and clientele exuding hip cred, the Metrograph has quickly morphed into a scene. A year later, the other side of town got its own oasis with the renovation and reopening of the Quad Cinema. A runty, plucky pioneer, the Quad was the city's first small-screen multiplex when it introduced itself in 1972. A quartet of shoebox theaters with a narrow lobby that on weekend date nights could get as clogged as a Greyhound bus gate. I always seem to have bum luck in my visits to the old Quad. Shortly after the start of one film, smoke began issuing out of the projection booth. Not a good sign. As I recall, it didn't prompt a George Costanza stampede to the exit, but a more orderly, disgruntled trudge, like soldiers moving out on patrol. Mishaps aside, the Quad had a lot going for it in its first incarnation. Multiple choices under one roof, an adventurous hodgepodge of films, first-rate popcorn, and proximity to Cinemabilia, the now-fabled movie-related bookstore, stocked with titles and magazines, that was run by Terry Ork, a bearded pan figure who managed the Bound for Guitar Glory band Television. Among Cinemabilia's employees was television bassist, ripped T-shirt model, and punk rock poet mode Richard Hell. Those rugged aesthetes who routinely caromed between the Quad and Cinemabilia on West 13th Street could practically apply for French citizenship. Cinemabilia is long gone, but the Quad has been reborn with improved seating, new screens to replace the old sheets, and extended lookbacks showcasing those who stand wholly high in estimation, a Daniel Day-Lewis tribute, and the fallen out of fashion, such as the resuscitation of the films of Italian director Lina Wertmüller, whose indignation inciting Seven Beauties and Swept Away gave everybody something to yap about in the 70s. The Quad ran into a hitch last November when it felt compelled to cancel a program of double bills selected by Louis C.K. after sexual harassment accusations caused the earth to open under his feet and swallow his career. Understandable, but a pity too, because C.K. revealed superb taste in film combos, Babyface and Dinner at Eight, Kubrick's Barry Lyndon and Renoir's The Rules of the Game. And it wasn't the movie's fault that the guy who chose them got shot down in shame. As the Louis C.K. cancellation reveals, the Weinstein effect presents a warp field for film revivalists going forward, a floating ethical and aesthetic quandary now that so many reputations have been corroded. The Quad's Daniel Day-Lewis salute didn't raise any red flags. Why should it? But a similar nod to Dustin Hoffman would be a dicey proposition now. Kevin Spacey, ditto. A Roman Polanski festival isn't something I'd want to pitch at the next meeting. Who knows? Woody Allen himself, the celebrator of Manhattan's revival houses, may eventually become too problematic an entity for his films to be fested without extensive disclaimers, trigger warnings, and juju dolls hung in the lobby to ward off negative energies. It probably won't come to that, but the Furies unleashed in 2017 have a lot of unfinished work to complete before things are set right, and woe to those who get in their way. Now on to society, to live and dine in L.A. Arriving at the local NBC station, a young anchorman found Hollywood's doors magically open. Half a century later, he writes about getting to know the likes of Cary Grant, Bob Hope, and Rosalind Russell by Tom Brokaw. Opening photo, not South Dakota. Afternoon tea in Beverly Hills, circa 1960. To the author, Los Angeles was another world. And in the photo, diners sit poolside, dressed in suits and skirts. In 1966, I drove onto the NBC News parking lot in Burbank, California, to begin what turned out to be a half century with this one organization, a heady trip through the history of the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st. On NBC's nickel, I landed in the midst of seismic change around the world and at home. The American convulsions of 1968, Watergate and the resignation of Richard Nixon, wars in the Middle East and Central America, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and the rebirth of China. Nelson Mandela arising from a stone-cold prison floor. Women the world over beginning a historic ascent to power. The deadly and disorienting attacks of September 11th. The arrival of the digital age. The first African-American president, followed by the first real estate mogul reality television star president. In one form or another, I've commented on those unforgettable experiences. But there was a part of my early days in California I've rarely discussed, except at dinner parties with friends, the unexpected and memorable encounters with the Hollywood luminaries of my youth. Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart, Gregory Peck, Rosalind Russell, Lauren Bacall, Milton Berle, Kirk Douglas, Jack Lemmon, Sidney Poitier, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, George Burns, even the occasional brush with Sinatra. They dressed elegantly, dined at Chasen's and the Bistro, attended one another's parties, and called the movies pictures. As they moved through Beverly Hills, Bel Air, and Malibu, they did so with confidence that they had earned their place and owed their fans the impression that the big screen presence was an authentic reflection of their everyday lives. When we arrived in Los Angeles, my wife, Meredith, and I were invited to dinners and cocktail parties well beyond our social standing, and at first I wondered why. As the anchor of the 11 o'clock news on KNBC, I spent my daytime hours covering the big political stories and the cultural upheavals and other events that were changing the contours of the Golden State. Moreover, the West Coast wrap of the day's news included the latest grim reports from Vietnam, summaries of the ever more distant, the ever more frequent generational divides in the country, and the continuing struggle for racial equality. It was reassuring that our ratings were strong and that Southern California was willing to get a summary of the day's unsettling news from a boyish 28-year-old. Then it dawned on me, from the San Fernando Valley to the moneyed environs of Beverly Hills, to the working-class neighborhoods of Inglewood and onto the beaches, late-night viewers were not so much enchanted with me as they were waiting for Johnny Carson and The Tonight Show. In Southern California, I was his friendly doorman and the beneficiary of his enormous popularity. That's the 11 o'clock news for now. Stay tuned for Johnny Carson was not just a sign-off. It was an overture for the master of late-night television. Like myself, a Midwesterner, who by the force of his popularity pulled me into his gravitational field. Meredith and I were living in a woodsy California bungalow in quaint Studio City, but we began to be invited to Sunday night screenings in Bel Air and Brentwood, or cocktail parties at the homes of people such as the fabled agent Irving Swifty Lazar. We'd find ourselves chatting with Henry Fonda, another Midwesterner, one night, and Lauren Bacall, another. Shirley MacLaine and her brother Warren Beatty we knew from covering California's political scene. At a Christmas party given by the actress Jennifer Jones, we were told we'd be sitting with Cary Grant. He was bringing his 4-year-old daughter Jennifer, who coincidentally had the same name and was about the same age as our eldest daughter. When Cary and his Jennifer arrived, another guest at our table nearly fainted from excitement, but wanted to be helpful, so she asked Jennifer Grant what she'd like for dinner. "Oh, just some strawberries," the child responded. The excited guest yelled to her date in the food line, "Roy, strawberries! Roy, strawberries!" Cary did a perfect Cary Grant take, cocking his head and saying, "Roy Strawberries, is he here? He's an old friend," followed by that sly Cary Grant smile. Everyone relaxed and never forgot the moment when old Roy Strawberries got his shout-out. At the opening of a new Northern California ski resort, Meredith and I got to know Edie Adams, the singer and widow of Ernie Kovacs, the manic television talk show host who had been killed in an auto accident. Kovacs was as careless with his finances as he was daring with his TV style. He left Edie with a pile of gambling and other debts, which she paid off with her singing and a seductive nightclub act. She confided that she was ready to have fun again, and would we come to dinner at the quirky mansion Kovacs had left behind? It was a memorable evening. From the moment we pulled into the driveway, Jack and Felicia Lemon were arriving at the same time as Tippi Hedren, who starred in Hitchcock's The Birds. Hedren was steaming. Her 15-year-old daughter had run off that day with a 20-something actor. These were the days before TMZ, but I had a scoop and didn't know it. Hedren's daughter grew up to be Melanie Griffith, the man she had run off with and married 3 years later was the then little-known Don Johnson, who went on to television fame in Miami Vice and to tabloid notoriety as the ego-infused Lothario of the 1980s and 1990s. Edie's dinner was a hoot. Meredith sat next to George Burns, who immediately nicknamed her Trixie and kept asking, "Trixie, where's our food? I came here for dinner." The dining room included a beautiful pool table, and Lemon, now listing to starboard from a few cocktails, insisted I partner with him to take on Jack Cassidy and Milton Berle. I played a pretty good game of pool, so I was reasonably confident, until Berle began to shoot. Uncle Milty was a shark, sinking 5 or 6 in a row and leaving the cue ball in a trapped position. Jack and I were creamed, but Jack wanted to up the stakes. $100 on the next game, he shouted, despite my protest. Milton killed us again, pocketed the money, put up his cue, and returned to his Uncle Milty personality, throwing off some corny joke. In those days, NBC's studios in Burbank were a hotbed of television production, with weekly tapings of Laugh In, The Andy Williams Show, Dean Martin, Sonny and Cher, Bob Hope's Christmas Special, and other programs. The facilities and technicians were prized for their musical productions, so I was not surprised one night when an engineer called and suggested I stick around after the 11 o'clock news. Frank was coming in. Sinatra had a post-midnight recording session scheduled with his home team, the Nelson Riddle Orchestra, and with Antonio Carlos Jobim, the masterly Brazilian guitarist who became an international star with his Beguiling the Girl from Ipanema. Shortly after midnight, I slipped to the back of the studio, where Dean Martin and Andy Williams recorded their weekly shows, and listened as Riddle and his players tuned up. Jobim sat up front, bent over his guitar, running a few riffs with the Riddle gang. Suddenly, Frank came striding in, accompanied by his wife, the elfin Mia Farrow. I had seen him on stage before, but this was a sighting I'll always remember. Here was a presence. As I recall, he was dressed in a silky tan sports jacket, just so slacks, and what looked like a silk shirt. He peeled off his jacket, set aside his hat, and greeted everyone cordially. "Hi, guys, how's it going? Nelson, let's do a take." The Girl from Ipanema never sounded better to me, but Sinatra said after the first take, "Nelson, I think a little heavy on the brass. Take it down a bit, and more strings, please." And so it went for the next hour, as I stood silently behind Farrow, who was wearing a baseball jacket and an expression of quiet devotion. About 2 a.m., I left for my car in the NBC News parking lot, thinking, as I often did in those days, well, I'm no longer in South Dakota. That lot was also where Bob Hope liked to park his big gold Chrysler, an annual gift from the car maker for his Christmas specials, broadcast on NBC. As a result, I had more than a nodding acquaintance with Bob, as he liked to catch up on the news and criticize our coverage of Vietnam. The parking friendship came in handy in an unexpected fashion one early December weekend. I was the host of a local Sunday morning talk show, and with less than 2 hours to airtime, the sole guest, Jesse Jackson, abruptly canceled. We had no backup. Suddenly, I remembered that Hope was scheduled to leave later that day for his Christmas appearances in Vietnam. I decided to throw a Hail Mary and see if he'd appear on my dinky little show. I had a private number, and one of his assistants put the call through. "Bob, I need a big favor. I have a show in an hour and no guest. Could you possibly appear and talk about your wartime specials?" I was stunned when he readily agreed and said his team would get him to the location. Our modest audience was beyond thrilled when Hope showed up and spent an hour telling jokes and recounted previous Christmas specials. When it was over, I walked him to the car, babbling about how appreciative I was for this huge favor. He stopped, put his arm around me and laughed. "Kid, you got me." "Got you? How?" I asked. "I never thought you'd ask me to be on such a small-time show, unless it was a setup for This Is Your Life, a hokey Ralph Edwards production on which well-known and unknown people were surprised with a glowing review of their life." We both laughed hard as I escorted him to his car for the trip to the airport and the flight to Vietnam. As Meredith and I were included in more high-profile but private events, we had a compact, enjoy the moment, but, like Cinderella, head for home when it's over. We knew our place, and it was not as members of this movable feast. The luminaries who did belong were there by rules of membership. A big screen star or a studio mogul, a powerful agent or a successful director or producers. The first month we were in Los Angeles, someone recommended Matteo's, a hot Italian restaurant run by one of Frank Sinatra's boyhood pals from Hoboken. The first night we were in there, Willie, the bartender, introduced us to a guy whose back was to us. It was Lee Marvin. He was cordial, but plainly preferred his own company. Later, by chance, we were temporary neighbors in Malibu, where I'd often see Marvin sitting on his stoop as I went for a run on the beach. He'd nod, but nothing more. Most mornings he seemed to be nursing a monumental hangover. He would lighten up when our 2-year-old daughter, Sarah, would wander by, giving him a giggling hello, but then he would retreat into his private reverie. Our neighbor on the other side was quite the opposite. Larry Hagman, later the Star of Dallas, would appear at our door in a caftan with an elaborate headdress and a flute. "Can the kids come out?" he'd ask. "I am putting on a parade." And so he would, leading a gaggle of tykes down the beach while tootling on his flute. Then everyone would be invited into his enormous hot tub where he kept a pair of geese. I once asked him how he had quit cigarettes. "Oh," he said, "easy. I just took up smoking dope. Of course, I tend to run into telephone poles while driving, but I no longer smoke cigarettes." At a party given by Swifty Lazar, who had kind of adopted us as his younger friends, I was unexpectedly approached by Rosalind Russell, the grande dame of screwball comedies, and of course Auntie Mame. She got right to the point. "Freddie, her husband, and I are celebrating our 30th anniversary in 10 days at the bistro. We have no young folks coming. I understand that beautiful young woman over there is your wife. Would you be our guest?"
Yes, I guess so. We'd be flattered."
"Do you have a tuxedo, Mr. Brokaw?"
"No."
"Rent one, and I will send a telegram to your home tomorrow with details." On the appointed Saturday night, we arrived upstairs at the bistro, both of us a little nervous. But Roz, by now we were on familiar terms, put us instantly at ease by whispering, "Just get through tonight with the old fogies, and next week we'll have lunch and gossip about it." Meredith and I were living on a modest income, and she had spent the most ever for a dress, the staggering sum of $150. With her classic beauty, she looked more like a movie star than like a young mother from the valley. I was seated with my pool-playing partner, Jack Lemon, and Fran Stark, the daughter of Fanny Bryce and wife of Hollywood producer, manager, legend Ray Stark. Other tables included Mary Benny, Jimmy and Gloria Stewart, Kirk and Ann Douglas, and California reigning royalty Governor Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Roz was a cheerful hostess as she walked among the tables, handing out old-fashioned Danish schoolboy caps for the men. Her husband was a Dane, and scarves for the ladies. She announced that dancing partners would be arranged by matching caps and scarves, and as she did so, she gave me a broad wink. I looked up to see Meredith being led onto the dance floor by Governor Reagan, who, it turns out, was a very good dancer. And so was Meredith, who, at age 30, was by far the youngest woman in the room. They were quickly the center of attention, as the rest of us stood aside to let them glide effortlessly across the floor. When the number ended, Meredith started back to her table, but the governor said, "No, let's do this again." They were about 2 bars into the second number when Nancy Reagan appeared at their side and said, "Ronnie, someone at our table has a question I can't answer. I need you there, now," and led him away. Next photo, wide-eyed, Brokaw in 1968, during his days as a news anchor at KNBC in Los Angeles. Lazar, the diminutive agent, producer, and man about town, had an unerring nose for a party, and when he heard that London's Wimbledon tennis tournament was the place to be in early July, he correctly assumed I could get him into the NBC hospitality tent, where tennis stars, show business luminaries, and even members of the royal family gathered. Come the 4th of July, Andy Williams was typically the showstopper at the tent when he sang America the Beautiful, but one year Andy was just the opening act. When he had finished singing, we all looked to the entrance to see Jack Nicholson behind his trademark sunglasses,
tanned, and turned out in a beautiful creamy silk suit. As he stood there, everyone was momentarily speechless, except for Swifty, who immediately called out, "Jack, Jack, how are you?" With that, Nicholson walked slowly across the tent floor, leaned over Swifty, took off his sunglasses, and with his killer smile said, "Irving, I've just been on Sam Spiegel's yacht in the Mediterranean with some young ladies. I came to London, where I picked up this beautiful silk suit. Now I am here at Wimbledon with you. Pause. I am very effing well. Thank you for asking." Lazar was always good for the telling anecdote. All that same week, to anyone he would encounter, he'd say, "Michael Caine is giving me a party," or, as Irving with his Brooklyn patois would pronounce it, "potty." "Saturday night at Langan's, you must come." That Saturday night, Meredith and I elbowed our way through to the back of a completely jammed upstairs room. We found Irving with a slight frown on his face. "I think Michael over-invited," he said with a straight face. One night, shortly after the big San Fernando Valley earthquake, I had to leave a Swifty dinner party to do the 11 o'clock news. As I was on my way out the door, Milton Berle said, "Hey, Tom, you know what California needs? Earth control pills." That night, I repeated the line as an introduction to our weatherman, and Berle was thrilled. 25 years later, I was having dinner at Spago when Wolfgang Puck asked me to say hello to Berle, who was not doing well. Milton, dining with friends, was bundled in a raincoat and staring blankly across the room when I approached. "Milton," I said, "Tom Brokaw, we knew each other a long time ago." He just stared at me, fingering an unlit cigar. Uncomfortable, I quickly greeted his friends and turned to leave. Milton reached out, grabbed my arm, and whispered, "Earth control pills."
Thank you.
This Vanity Fair Spotlight is by David Camp. Love at First Script, with photograph by Jeff Lipsky. Kumail Nanjiani photographed off Marina Del Rey, California. It's well documented that Kumail Nanjiani grew up adoring the Richard Curtis, Hugh Grant romantic comedies of the 90s, in particular Four Weddings and a Funeral. But what's so appealing about Nanjiani's own romantic comedy, The Big Sick, which he wrote with his wife, Emily V. Gordon, and which is based on the story of their courtship, is that it is sui generis, wearing no obvious influences on its sleeve. We wanted to take the tropes of the rom-com and tell a different kind of story, says Nanjiani, sort of like what Jordan Peele did with Get Out. He was able to take the horror genre, the tropes of which people are very aware of, and use it to say something new, from a different point of view. Of late, Peele and the Nanjiani-Gordon team have often been mentioned in the same breath, as serious contenders in the screenplay categories during this awards season. More melancholic than frothy, and anchored by rumpled, contrivance-free performances by Nanjiani and Zoe Kazan, The Big Sick addresses such subjects as the sudden onset of a medical crisis, the penurious, uncertain lives of aspiring stand-up comics, and most impressively, the pain and guilt associated with assimilation. Nanjiani's character risks excommunication from his Pakistani immigrant family for not submitting to an arranged marriage. Yet The Big Sick's cumulative effect is somehow uplift and fun. You know what's cool? Nanjiani asks. Now a lot of people are seeing it on airplanes. I'll get tweets from people saying, I saw it on the plane, and I saw other people watching it. It was all The Big Sick and Wonder Woman. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.